Music from Keith and Kristen Getty. Hear, O Israel. We heard from Michael Card, Tell the World That Jesus Loves You. And from Dave Pettigrew, What Would I Do If I Didn't Have You to Love Me? 10 and a half minutes after the hour on a Wednesday morning here on The Broken Road. We're joined by Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times out Washington Way. Doug, good morning to you.
Good morning, guys.
And good morning.
We're into the Christmas
season. Happy Advent.
Yeah. I was just going to say the word Advent. Advent just means like beginning, doesn't it? Or birth? Does it refer specifically to birth?
On the verge of.
Uh-huh. On the verge of? Okay. Wait, on the leading edge of.
Is today the. No, was it. When did the. When did Advent begin?
I think it's this coming Sunday, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, it is. Okay. It continues for a number of weeks. I ran across a fascinating link. I was over at Internet Monk Saturday reading Jeff Dunn's Ramblings column, and he linked to a book review on CNN on their faith pages. And lo and behold, it was a book written and just out by Pope Benedict XVI. And it turns out that the Pope has written a Jesus trilogy. And the third book in the trilogy has just been released. It's entitled Jesus of Nazareth, The Infancy Narratives. And it was relevant particularly to this time of the year because it deals with a couple of Christmas-related, you could call them traditions, that he's kind of debunked. One had to do with the date of Jesus' birth, and pardon me, but I assume this was common knowledge that we all have realized that Jesus was not born in the year zero, or even the year one, that scholars have known for a long time that it was probably 4 to 6 B.C. But in the book, the Pope gives the reason by saying that there was a monk in the 6th century that simply miscalculated the dates. Now, I'm just reading a review of the book, not the book itself, so maybe the book offers more detail on this. But I have often wondered why year one started 4 to 6 years after Jesus' birth, and apparently now we have an explanation. Doug, were you aware of that goof?
I'm aware of the goof. I'm not aware of the details of the goof, and that's probably for one basic reason. I only get enthralled with facts or artifacts, if you will, that have something to do with understanding the original meaning of the text, of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And so whether Jesus's, birth was plus or minus 3 years here or there is really not of interest to me, because what matters is the fact that he was born. So I pick and choose the facts I dig into.
Well, you could see this as kind of Bible trivia, I suppose.
Yeah, it's more historical trivia, if you will. But mm-hmm. at Preserving Bible Times here, we're all about integrated biblical context for the purpose of discerning the original meaning of passages and narratives. And so that particular piece of data doesn't impact our understanding of the passage at all from interpretation, insight, wisdom point of view.
This next one may pull you in a little bit deeper, because he also just in, and again, I haven't read the book. I've just read the review of the book. He mentioned that there were no large animals, like we're so inclined to think. So I'm thinking all these nativity sets out there where there's an oxen and a sheep and a donkey and a moo cow are now in error. You should put those back in the box, because it turns out, according to the Pope's book, there were no large animals there. Now, we've talked about this before, and you know why there were no large animals, don't you, Doug?
Yeah, and people have accused me through the years of obsoleting 50 million creche sets, when we give our Advent presentation on the real birth of Jesus. But before I jump into that particular one, and that is of interest, I find it ironic here that the Pope is debunking, if that's the word, or rewriting, if that's the word here, certain traditions, because the Catholic Church, in its own way, has set so many traditions in motion that may or may not be related directly or indirectly to the biblical text at all. I think a really good example is the tradition that we've had for 1,200 years now, that Jesus was a carpenter. We think that gets traced back to about 850 A.D. when the Catholic Church decided that, we're going to call him a carpenter. And in the Catholic theology, tradition has equal weight with Scripture. And so, tradition has a profoundly important role in Catholicism, and it's just sort of ironic to me that the Pope now comes along and is going to debunk some of the traditions that have grown up around Christmas.
Well, and that's not really the purpose of his book. And the reviewer, her name was Laura Sparks, said that in fact the Vatican spokesman said about the Pope, he's not there to debunk traditions. That wasn't his purpose, because he's a very traditional sort of guy. But his purpose in writing this trilogy was to present Jesus as an historical person who ate and slept and walked and talked with people just like us every day of his earthly ministry. He was a real person, flesh and blood. And that's the purpose of the Pope's writing. So I guess, in a sense, you could see him at odds with the Catholic traditions, but he's also a realist. And I think this is a profound purpose in this book, and I hope he accomplishes it.
Well, I just see, for me, some dot connecting there, is that even in our Western traditions, in Protestantism, it seems that tradition sometimes has a stronger grip on us than the actual truth of the situation. And I think we see that a lot surrounding the birth narratives. But setting that observation aside, let's deal with the large animals. The first tradition we kind of have to deal with here is that there probably was no stable, at least as we Westerners think of the word stable. The second thing we have to deal with is where was the birth site for Jesus? And we think, because of some writings around a little after 200 AD, that somebody set in motion this thought that Mary and Joseph got to Bethlehem so late on a certain night, let's say after 10 p.m., that when they went to the local Motel 6, you know, old Tom didn't leave the light on for them, and then they saw the no vacancy sign. Tom Burdett, yeah, that's who he is, from Motel 6. But this notion of an inn really is a tradition that's been with us for quite some time. But the Greek word, at least in Luke, as Luke gives us to it, in Luke 2:7, because there was no room for them in the kataluma, is the Greek word there. And that kataluma is best understood as guest room. There is a word for inn, pandoxion, in the Greek. But and Jesus actually uses that word when he gives the Good Samaritan story. But that is such a different Greek word, in no way it could ever be confused for kataluma here. So, you know, we have to deal with that imposition of tradition into the text, that it really was a guest room. Now, let me just pause here for a moment. It's not a secret that the word inn is a very inappropriate translation in just about every Bible that we have out there. I have been at Christian publishers, big names. I've had this discussion with them. And I'm not the only one. There are lots of people who know that the word inn is mistranslated. The word is kataluma. But the answer you get is fascinating. It reminds me of my days in the corporate world, where people used to say marketing is everything and everything is marketing. The reason Christian publishers are hesitant, in fact, almost unwilling, to change the word inn to guest room is because if they did, people would think that this is a very inaccurate Bible and it wouldn't sell very well. So the irony of tradition is it now has such a strong grip that if we were to undo tradition, people would think there's something wrong with their Bibles and they wouldn't sell, and marketing is everything and everything is marketing, so let's not change what we know to be an error.
Your word irony comes across to me as duplicity. Is what it does. Sorry to say that, but just that's just kind of the way it is.
Sometimes there's a fine line between the two. Okay, so now we pick up this thought of kataluma. Well, that's a guest room. Well, what are we to make of that? Well, when you get into the construction of these one-room homes, and we need to remember here that 90% of the people in the first century living in Israel or Judea, Samaria, Galilee, are really, really poor people, and they live in one-room houses. But it's not perfectly a one-room family room. It may be 12 by 15 inches square. It's a slight rectangle. At one end of this one room is what we call a wall divider. It's really like a big canister set. And in this divider is where the grains are held. And on the other side of this granary separator, which divides off one end of this big one room, there's like a 3.5-4 foot space that's called the cataluma, the guest room. And the reason that's there can be traced to the fact that hospitality is mandatory in this Near Eastern culture. You're all part of a clan. Clans travel to the festival in Jerusalem. Bethlehem is, you know, 5 miles south of Jerusalem. And the rabbis have also decreed that an observant Jewish man cannot sleep in the same room with another man's wife. And so you have this little guest room, this cataluma, that is a separate room from the main one-room living room, family room that the whole family lives in. And so for hospitality reasons, you have to be able to put people up, but you have to be able to put them up in such a way that you don't all sleep in the same room and keep the rabbis happy. So that's what this little guest room is. So that's really helpful for us to understand.
It was really kind of a psychological barrier. It wasn't really a wall.
It's really a wall. I mean, there's a little, at the end of it, there's a little passageway that you can get behind this wall. Mm-hmm. But yes, I can show you pictures of homes in this construction, and it pretty much looks like a wall.
Mm, okay.
But it has what we would consider a doorway at one end of it there, so mm-hmm. you can actually access this space and get in and out of it in the evening and in the morning. So as far as we can tell, there probably are no more than 2,000 people living in Bethlehem at the time of Jesus. Just as an observation, that's a really hard number to know because Bethlehem has been such a revered site for so long that no archaeology has really ever taken place much around Bethlehem, unlike so many other places in Israel. So because it's been such a sacred site for so long and off limits to digging and archaeology, there's a lot we don't know that we'd really love to know about the size of Bethlehem at the time of Jesus. But anyway, current estimates are about 2,000. And if we have a mom and dad and 4 kids in the average family, that's, you know, no more than 300 homes. And so the question is, why would 300 catalumas, 300 guest rooms, be off limits to this couple? And she's pregnant and about to give birth. There's no question that Mary and Joseph are part of the Davidic clan. That means they're entitled to mandatory hospitality. They didn't get there too late at night. I mean, Luke is very clear in his text here that while they were there, is his exact words. We don't know whether they've been in the Bethlehem vicinity for 2 months, 2 weeks, or 2 days. But one thing is clear, they didn't show up that night. Why is it that a member of the clan of David, where hospitality is mandatory, and a woman about to give birth, which would give her the highest priority for hospitality, why is it that none of those 300 guest rooms can be made available to them? That's the pregnant question, I would suggest, that comes out of that verse 2:7 in Luke. There was no room for them in the cataluma. Luke is telling us something here that should just raise our eyebrows and immediately cause us to stand at attention and ask the question, what in the world is going on here?
Well, now, in fairness, this was a time when people who were from the Davidic tribe or line were going back to their home territories to be counted in a census. This travel had been made mandatory by Caesar. By Augustus. And so he went there along with probably a lot of other people with Davidic roots, going back to Bethlehem. Although, would they have all gone to Bethlehem? Was that like a seat, like a county seat for relatives of David? What makes Bethlehem the home of members of that group? I mean, was that the only place where if you were of the line of David, you would go?
That's where it was set up, so to speak. That's where the flag was planted in the ground. I think your county seat is probably a pretty good analogy here. But there's another question that goes with this. In this culture, you pretty much are born, live, and die, and never move more than a half mile away or walk more than a half mile away of the town in which you were born and which you will die, except for your trips to the festivals in Jerusalem. you just stay where you were born. And so it's just the fascinating question here. Again, that's begged when you put the narratives together. If Joseph and Mary are of the clan of David, what in the world are they doing living 90 miles north in Nazareth? It's a whole nother issue. It's a whole nother question. It's a whole nother contextual theme to dig in. And I love digging into that theme, but it takes 15 or 20 minutes to develop. But I just want to make that observation. It's an open question. How many people were traveling and went to Bethlehem? Were there a lot or were there few? And here's another piece of data. Normally, when we think of a census, we think of an election night, and we think of everybody going to the voting booths, within one 24-hour period of time. Actually, these Roman censuses would take anywhere from a year or two from beginning to end. So it doesn't necessarily follow that everybody from all the outsiders who didn't live in and near Bethlehem all arrived, at the same moment in time to take up all the rooms in here. This census would have been spread out over 18 months, most likely.
Yeah, that makes sense then. So, yeah, so people traveling over that length of time to their various places. maybe the rejection had something to do with the nature of the couple, if they were even of the clan of David, because they were out-of-towners. I mean, they came from Galilee, not the highest social references out of Galilee. Could that have maybe overridden their connections with David?
No, I think that would be a weak argument. Another piece of data here from the Mishnah, we learn that the clan of David every July is mandated to do the wood offering in the temple in Jerusalem. So we call it the Davidic wood offering of the month of July. And that means that the male members of the clan would gravitate to Bethlehem and Jerusalem to be part of that mandated proceeding. Well, I would suggest to you that Joseph comes down every July to Bethlehem and participates with the clan in the Davidic wood offerings in the temple in Jerusalem. And as part of that, he would be known by the clan. And one July, he shows up and said, "Do I have good news? I am betrothed to a wonderful lady named Mary, and she's of the house of David as well." You pretty much marry within your clan. And so they would, I would suggest, were very much aware of who Joseph is in Bethlehem and of his betrothal. And so when he shows up one summer night, we could deal with that later, trying to discern the time of the year that this most likely took place, but I would suggest to you it's summer. We can argue whether it's early or late, but it certainly isn't December 25. He shows up with this very pregnant woman, presumably riding on a donkey. What do you think the reaction is of the people in Bethlehem when they see Mary and a very pregnant Mary and Joseph show up and say, "Here we are"?
I would say shock.
You're absolutely right. Because their first comment was, seeing an obvious pregnant Mary, they're going to say, "When was the wedding feast and why weren't we invited?" It would be mandatory to invite the clan to the wedding feast, okay? And they knew of David's betrothal because he was, Joseph's betrothal because he was coming to the city of David in every July. And they want to know why they were shamed, if you will, why they were shunned, why they weren't invited to the wedding feast in Nazareth to celebrate the wedding of this two. And Joseph probably says, "Well, because there was no wedding feast." And so what do you think their immediate reaction is?
Adultery.
Absolutely. This may have been a glorious night from the perspective of heaven, but from the perspective of the Davidic clan, this thing stinks. This has the stench of adultery. And because this is observant Judaism, no one is going to let this adulterous couple into their little tiny one-room home to spend time in their kataluma, their guest room.
Now, this was adultery is a capital crime, right?
It is. But it would be the issue for the people in Bethlehem. Why didn't the people in Nazareth take care of this? So it's a few issues here that probably don't directly translate to them. And then we also learn in Mishnaic literature, it's not automatic that you're stoned. You can be just shunned, you know, sort of like you have a scarlet letter on your forehead for the rest of your days, forbidden to marry. Your son would always be known as the I won't use the total word here.
You can
son
say,
of
you can
Mary
say the word
in Roman
here, that's okay.
genealogically records.
Yeah. It has a literal meaning. We can use the word.
Yeah, he would be known officially as the bastard son of Mary in the genealogical records of that time. And part of the intrigue of that is, if that's really true of who you are, that means you're forbidden to marry another person. So the whole Dan Brown theory of the Da Vinci Code just sort of goes up in smoke there, that Jesus would have married Mary Magdalene. So there's some interesting loose ends here. But to get back to the main thing, if the 300 guest rooms of these small, poor, mostly single room houses with a little side room called the Cataluma are off limits to this couple, where are they going to go? And now we have to get further into house construction of these little one room houses. And there's dozens and dozens of different ways that these things were built. But a common denominator is they all have a small animal holding area, either as a sub basement or as a drop down recession at one end of this one room family room here. And I've actually got pictures of some of those, of what they look like. And when you take a peek in there, they're completely dark. There are no windows, these small animal holding areas underneath this one-room home. And it's probably maybe 4 foot tall at the maximum. And it kind of stinks, you know, because there's animal manure droppings on the floors, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where the family would keep either the sheep or the goats and the chickens. And they're kept there for protection at night and also in the winter months. The heat from the sheep or goats, you know, rises up by convection and helps to be a small bit of a warming impact on the home. And it would seem that some compassionate member of the House of David said, look, Joseph, Mary, I can't let you into my Cataluma. And as you know, nobody will let you into their Catalumas in town tonight. But I tell you what, I'm willing to give you the small animal holding pen basement if you're up to it. And you can make that for your abode here to give birth. And now this all cycles back to your opening observation. The size of those spaces is such that a cow or a horse wouldn't fit in them. But it's actually more basic than that. There really are no cows in the Bethlehem area. You have to have grazing pastures for cows. They have to have grass all year round. And if you're familiar with that environment at all, the grasses may grow for 60 days in the late spring, and then the summer heat comes and the lack of rain comes, and everything withers up and dries away. The psalmist makes reference to that phenomena from time to time, and there would be nothing for cows to feed on. So it's virtually impossible for cows that have been part of that environment at all. And the same is pretty much true for horses. The Philistines may have horses, you know, centuries before for running their chariots up and down the coast. But at best, we're dealing with donkeys here in this kind of a culture. So long-winded answer to your question, I would suggest the Pope is right on that one. There are no cows. There are no horses. There is no stable. And actually, there is no manger in the wooden, cross-legged, raised sense that we know that. A manger would be made from straw and clay and sometimes animal dung, and molded in sort of a rectangular, 4 foot long, 18 inches wide, scooped out, recessed kind of feeding trough. That's what the manger would have been like in that sub basement of these small single room homes in Bethlehem.
So in summary, when you put out your nativity sets this Christmas season, keep the ox in the box. No donkeys. No alarm. You got to find a chicken and a goat to add to the assembly.
We could say, and don't horse around with the scene either.
Yeah, indeed. So yeah, we started talking, for those of you just tuning in, we started talking about Pope Benedict's new book. Actually, it's a trilogy. The third book of the trilogy has just been released. It's called Jesus of Nazareth, The Infancy Narratives. And in the course of his writing, he has debunked a number of Christmas traditions or misconceptions that we've had for a long, long time. And I think I'm going to email Hallmark and see if they can redesign their Christmas card line for this year. And among those was the fact that there were no large animals. Another story that the Pope takes issue with is that the angels sang to the shepherds. And I'm thinking that probably comes from A Christmas Carol. You know, we get this picture of these shepherds on the hillsides. And Doug, I think we'll deal with this probably maybe next time or the week after, because I know you have a lot to say about the shepherds on the hillsides, and it has to do with the date, the time of the year when Jesus was really born. But he says the angels didn't sing. And in fact, if you look at Luke, it doesn't say the angels sang. The angels said. They praised God, and they said. And I think maybe we've enlarged on that picture, maybe gave it a little Broadway twist with northern lights and hordes of angels and wings and harps and music and trumpets and really gussied it up beyond what the real scene must have been like. But Doug, you're so good at painting those pictures for us. That wasn't the way it worked, huh?
Well, I mean, if they didn't sing, was it a chant? Was it a Gregorian chant? You know, there's some real issue here. The correct translation for heavenly hope, which is the traditional phrase, really, if we get down into the Greek, it's a vast heavenly army. A vast heavenly army of angels. So, you know, there's a lot of implications here that be fun to dig into next time.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking that, you know, and we've talked numerous times here about how humble the beginnings of Jesus were, and we've painted that picture in the animal pen in the house that you can't come in more secretively than that. Why announce it with 1,000 angels, especially if Herod's on the look for this young child? I would think security reasons alone would say that we'll just do it low key here. We'll low key this thing. And if the heavenly host were to sing to me, it would have been at the resurrection. That's the time for song and celebration. So we'll delve into this in future weeks here during the Advent season, because we have a lot to say about the traditions and things we observe year after year here, some of which might not coincide, might not jive with the actual history. David, you're looking thoughtful there.
Well, I'm involved in puppetry. Mm-hmm. At my church.
Yeah. I saw you practice,
and that's something new, and I just thought I'd put you guys on notice that sometime in the far, far future, there's going to be a new tradition, and I think we may have started it, and it's going to be the this nativity story told from the viewpoint of the dogs left behind to take care of the sheep after the shepherds went.
Ooh.
So that's the dogs are, you know,
your puppets, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, and their puppets, well, the dog puppets will, the border collies will talk and trade and you know, pick up, tell the story and Seymour, he's the tallest shepherd. You know, he was the one that saw the whole thing first, and he passed the word I don't want to spoil the story, but I mean, someday there's going, maybe a future pope will say, I wonder where that tradition started.
Yeah.
So we know.
And we'll blame it on you.
Yeah, you can blame it on me.
Doug Greenwald was with Preserving Bible Times. There's a website, preservingbibletimes.org, which you can link to from our website if you're listening on brokenroadradio.com this morning. And you'll learn to love the site. There's a marvelous cache of resources there that you can use in your church, in your small groups, in your Bible studies. And a lot of photos that will, in themselves, teach you a lot about the Holy Land and the whole point of the ministry. Well, Doug, maybe I should let you say that. The point of the ministry is what? It's context.
To preserve and present biblical truth. That's our purpose. And our strategy is to do that via what we call integrated contextual restoration. That's to take all of the cultural, literary, geographical, visual, and historical contextual pieces that were given in the narratives here and reconstruct how that passage would have been understood by the people who first heard those words. Because it's in the original meaning, it's in the original intended timeless understanding of the passage that we find the power of transformation.
And Doug, you've said many times that the geography is the fifth gospel.
It is. And you see, and it already factors into our discussion of the birth narratives. We should always ask, where are we? Well, we know where Bethlehem is, but we forget where Nazareth is. It's 90 miles apart. That's an enormous distance. Clans don't live apart. They all live together in the same village, the same town, the same city. Just by understanding the geography of Bethlehem and Nazareth raises a series of questions that we have to answer that actually factor into our understanding of the birth narratives.
And we'll be delving into those again next week, Wednesday morning, when Doug joins us from the ministry just on the outskirts of Washington. Columbia, Maryland is the home of Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, we'll look forward to that. Thank you so much for what you
Well, thanks. I just want to say one thing to David. Did I hear, David, that your dog's name is Seymour in the play?
They'd be one of the shepherds.
Because it's an absolute fascinating play on words. You want to see more about this event?
Hey, good choice, David.
It through my eyes.
Well, actually, truth to tell, I don't think the dialogue has been written yet. And I've got a feeling that I'm the one that might. Well, I mean, I'm not sure. The idea is there. I'm not sure if the dialogue and the script has been written yet, but that might be on me.
Yeah, so. I love it when David has an idea, because his frontal lobe kind of begins to swell and throb. There, I think there's probably a good story in there, David.
Something happens during election season.
Doug, thank you. Be blessed. Talk to you next week.